This is Shaping Places, the podcast where we meet the people helping to shape the world around us and ask them to reflect on the places that have shaped them. I'm Dave Erasmus, speaker, coach, and thinker, and I enjoy turning big questions into impactful projects for others. I'm joined by my co-host, Matt Mason, Head of Innovation and Skills at the Crown Estate, and together we work with The Conduit on impact and sustainability. Our guests today are Eric and Katrine, a father and daughter pair of freedivers who have campaigned tirelessly to protect local kelp forests. And since the 2021 trawler ban, they've already seen signs of recovery, and they're carrying that momentum forward through Sussex Underwater, a community group dedicated to protecting and educating about marine life. So today we'll dive into these magical underwater worlds, hear how they've shaped Eric and Katrine, and discover why they're determined to protect them. Welcome.
Hi, Dave. Nice to be here. Thanks for having us with you.
It's really good to get here. We've been looking forward to this for a while.
Eric, let's start with you. Why don't you tell us a bit about where you grew up?
Well, I'd like to start back a bit further, really, with my father. He came from the Fenlands, country boy, in 1938, joined the army and was sent out the expeditionary forces to Belgium. And he actually got right back to Dunkirk. And being a country lad, he brought his troop back. You can look on a flat land like the northern France. It's completely flat. And there'll be people out there you can't see because they've got dikes. And Dad knew that the poachers walked on the bottom of the dikes, the piles there. So he brought his whole troop back to Dunkirk intact. And then commandeered a rowing boat and got back from there. So, and all our holidays were spent in the Fenlands, although he stayed down here from the Fens. He met my mum, who was a Brighton lady. All our holidays were in the Fens, so he taught me the way to the country.
So he was teaching you sort of how to be at one with nature for the sake of safety.
Exactly, being at one with nature.
And you mentioned your mum as a Brighton lady. So is that where you grew up?
Oh, yeah, Brighton Hove mainly. And Shoreham in my later life, obviously.
I think you talk about it, don't you, Dad, like it's your Garden of Eden back then in your childhood, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, I think my basic thing in life is to get the seeds back to what they were when I was a child. You imagine the year 1959 when I started diving as an 11-year-old. The seas have been virtually closed since 1939, right around to 44. The beaches weren't open again really till 52. The trawlers have been taken away to requisition by the Navy to be used as mine sweepers or whatever you wanted, whatever they want to use them for. So they hadn't really started work again. So the fish had a 10-year reprieve, really. It was just a different world.
Just thinking about the fact that you sort of lived your life as a teenager in the water.
Well, when I first encountered the water, I was staying on the water's edge as an 11-year-old, and I can't remember, I was fishing or just down the beach. I was always down the beach where he lived about a mile away, so I was walking down there, a bunch of kids, and a fella got out with a wetsuit on, big fella. I think his name was Dead-Eyed Nick, because he used to go fishing. He's a local hero in the paper, and I thought, oh, we've got a big fish there. I could do that. And at the same time, I've been watching Sea Hunt on television. That was Lloyd Bridges back in 1959 and doing impossible things underwater. I went home, took out my life savings at the time. That was 50p, or 10 shillings, and bought a complete kit from Woolworths. Face mask, snorkel fins. The funny thing is, the mask was actually not a lot of good. It was plastic. So all my mates had plastic masks, but my dad actually whittled down a piece of glass, where it's proper glass, there's no refraction, so you could see out of it a lot easier. And he put a strap on it, and off I went. I never looked back, really. The first dive, 13, 14 kids swimming out to sea. Lovely flat white sand. And then we saw black weed, the kelp. What the hell is that? From day one, you could realise all the life that was in this kelp. I mean, kelp stayed with me for the rest of my life, really. So I'd swim out to sea, perhaps half a mile, three quarters of a mile, maybe a mile, just to get out of the way. And all I could practice here is one dog on the beach, and you dive down, you're part of nature. Absolutely.
So it's peaceful out there for you a mile out?
Yeah, completely.
Did you notice a difference between yourself and your friends that didn't spend time in the water? Like, did you think about how it might have shaped you, or did it just feel...
How can I explain it?
I think it's made you a very mindful person and also a very optimistic person. So Dad has a very different attitude to a lot of people, I think, in that way, that because he's been in the sea for so long and he has that mindful environment around him so much, you do become, like you're saying, part of nature. Now I know, because I've learned to dive over the last couple of years. Yes. I understand now what Dad's been going on about all these years, that actually it is a very mindful way to be, because you just completely immersed in the environment. And when I was little, my first words were, "Daddy's gone diving." Literally.
I'd just like to elaborate on that. That was why my friends up, it might be blowing a hurricane in January and they ring up and say, "Dad, no, he's out diving."
But yeah, it's shaped you in a certain way, hasn't it?
Yeah.
And you've become that sort of person that is very much more mindful, optimistic person because of it.
It's all about relaxation as well. It's better to dive inside of it, because if you're relaxed, stuff will come to you. The fish know you're there. I would be in 1 meter visibility, a shoal of bass would come around and scatter, but always come back to me.
I'm just keen to provoke and poke a little more into that Garden of Eden that you grew up with. So it was actually a flourishing, biodiverse haven when you were a teenager.
Because the kelp was there. The kelp ran all the way from Eastbourne virtually right to the Isle of Wight and carried on down the West Country. That was clean in the water. I can remember one day in particular where we was going out to a local wreck called the Indiana, about a mile and a half from Worthing. And as we went along in the boat in the shallows, the water was dirty. Came back 2 or 3 hours later and the water was crystal clear because the kelp catches all that stuff, all that bits and pieces, and holds it out of suspension.
So the kelp is a good thing.
Oh, unbelievable.
It's like our rainforest, isn't it? That's the way we describe it. It's like our rainforest. The biodiversity that you get within a kelp forest.
Like
80,000 different creatures you can get in a kelp forest. It's amazing. But also it does lots of things, doesn't it? Because it captures carbon as well. My dad was saying it filters the water. It's a nursery ground for all the species that we have in the sea. It's a nursery ground for them. It protects them from other predators, but it also stops the beaches washing away.
I'd love to drag you out of the sea. I'd love to hear about what Hove was like.
It makes you think a lot simpler than it was these days. Far less high-rise buildings, the buses came on time. My house is a mile from the sea, but we would walk down the seafront. Obviously, no health and safety, because we'd go to the wrong side of the railings on the beach, you know, with waves and stones crashing overhead. How we ever didn't get dragged out to sea, I don't know. Yeah. I'll take, for instance, we always carried knives, you know, for cutting bits of wood, but we'd never, ever think of using it for any other reason than mucking around as kids.
So was it a good place to grow up in?
Brilliant, yeah. Mum used to kick us out. Well, we kicked ourselves out, actually. And we would be off over the downs, and you'd come back when dinner was ready late in the evening. And obviously, we knew the local downs as well. We knew where the rabbits were and everything else. It was incredible, really. Yeah, a different world, definitely a different world. It's a lot more diverse, Hove. When you go to the Fenlands, where my dad used to live, it's flat as a pancake, and the jobs were on the land. And the land was actually becoming less dependent on people. When my father came down to Preston Barracks for the Royal Artillery after he trained at Woolley's Arsenal, and he met my mum there. And so when he eventually came back from the war, 6 years later, well, they were married in 1944, actually, but he had the option of staying here or going home. And Brighton was a lot more diverse, or Hove was a lot more diverse, more things to do. So I think that's why they stayed here, luckily for me.
Oh, yeah.
Amongst the most diverse places
diverse
in the country.
Place to live, yeah.
Well, we live in Shoreham now, which is
It's a wonderful place to live, Shoreham, because you've got literally the downs right behind you. You've got the river and you've got the sea. So you've got kind of everything. And it feels like, I think what you're saying is you've got that lovely hub of a nice town and very kind of up and coming town with brilliant culture. But then you've also got surrounding it, you've got nature. And I love that as well, growing up in Shoreham as well. And I love that feeling of going out in nature, being able to access it so easily.
What changed? What's been changing from that Garden of Eden that you grew up in? What happened?
It sneaked up on us, really. I've been keeping diaries all my life. When I look back on the diary, looking up the kelp, it read like a horror story. Until, you know, by 2003, 2004, the big beds are gone. And we got pictures, actually, from 20 years ago. We found a historic film, which wasn't on kelp, but it was maintenance work, and we could look at the kelp. The difference in that 20 years. Areas that used to be covered in kelp, the trawlers were working, they couldn't get into the area in...
Talking about trawling, aren't you?
Trawling.
So this is the bit that doesn't always get explained. So a trawler boat is different to a normal, what we'd call a sustainable fishing boat.
Set boat.
It doesn't have set nets. It has these nets that are kind of towed along and basically at the back of the boat, a very, very heavy net. with chains kind of holding it together, and it will pull it along the seabed, actually along the floor of the seabed. So it's quite different to a normal fisherman going out with their set nets and kind of taking fish from it.
Fishermen, local fishermen would be pulling stuff from the middle of the water, for example.
Set nets, were to put down, no damage, pull them back up, they haven't damaged the bottom.
Oh, you mean they're hanging from a buoy or something?
Yeah, be on buoys, and they lay on the bottom, but when they're pulled up, they don't pull the bottom up with them. But the big trawlers just go across the bottom. Then they paired the boats up. They put a trawler on the back 1.5 times as big. They even went to the degree of one time, I got an eyewitness on it, they put chains between the boats to get the kelp out of the way.
They paired up. The net that they were towing between them was then twice as big.
And the thing is, it was for 3 months, May, April, early June, every year, 30 years. What we explain on some of our talks we give is, if you've got an ancient woodland, which a kelp was an ancient woodland, it had been there since the last ice age. So you've got an ancient woodland and a man wants to catch a rabbit. So he comes in with a bulldozer. Mm-hmm. Bulldozer it flat, takes his 2 rabbits away, and then comes back every day for 3 months, for 30 years. There's no ancient forest left.
Yeah. If you're in a woodland trying to catch a rabbit, you might step on a couple of plants. You might take out 2 or 3 bits trying to get one.
Yeah.
But you were talking about 80,000 species, of which it's probably capturing most of that when it's dragging along the bottom.
This is the other thing with trawling. It's indiscriminate. Whereas a sustainable fisherman will be looking for a certain type of fish when he's fishing and putting others back that he might catch. A trawler comes along and it will just take everything in its wake. And that's the other problem. It's so indiscriminate.
So they've taken the kelp away. And finally, they break through the crust, what we call the crust, which is all being bound together with mussels and everything else. And then the boulders become loose and the boulders start rolling around in the big storms like giant cannonballs or marbles. The bottom just degrades and degrades and degrades. You can't destroy a farm and expect it to keep coming back time after time after time.
Yeah.
So what started happening then was the fish stocks were obviously then reducing. And that's when, so people like Dad and the divers were seeing it with an eyewitness of what was happening.
I've been writing letters for a long time to the fisheries, anyone else who want to listen, and you get either nothing back or they've got grandfathered rights. And we found out through time that as the fish stocks keep coming down, I'm going to go right back to 1870, first steam trawlers coming again, first 20 years, no problem at all. Loads of fish coming out, and then it started going downhill, and it started going downhill, and it hit. First World War was a peak where they stopped fishing. Second World War was a peak. Then it flatlined right down the bottom. But when it flatlined, all they'd done was bought bigger trawlers, heavier gear, more powerful stuff, better technology, were able to go out and find the fish that were hiding in pockets.
And so take us into your diary then. Can you take us into what it then felt like to be going into these kelp forests that you would... Well, there were once in Eden.
Lack of kelp forests. They're virtually gone. The one that really hit me really hard was Bognor Reef, which is a natural reef of Bognor Regis. The bream always went on the southwest side, right on the edge of the reef. They dig these beautiful pods. And the pods are very vital. They dig them down to the chalk or the rock base. Little edges turn up. Every time the tide comes across, it gets aerated. Because they're digging holes, they're digging up worms, crustaceans. The fish are coming into those holes, other fish, to feed on what they're digging up. So you get rays there, you get cuckoo wrasse, you get pollock, you get bass coming through in the hundreds. We dove there 1 week. It was actually like a Garden of Eden, for want of a better word. The fish were everywhere. The following Saturday, back out again, expecting to see this mind-blowing world. We come up on the promenade, pair of trawlers going right down the outside of the reef. And when we got there, it was total destruction. The beds had been smashed, there's boulder in the middle of the beds, all the kelp had been ripped up. And all we had was fish about 3 inches long, small bream, trying to rebuild their holes. And the boats were so full, it was what they call pop-outs, little 2 or 3 inch fish, bream and bass, on the surface, dying in rafts. Well, that broke my heart. So I wrote a letter in an article, I thought, I've got to do something about this. I wrote to everyone I could get in touch with. I sent it to the fisheries, it sat on their desk. It took 10 years to get it through, which is another thing that gets my goat. Why, when we know it's wrong, does it take so bloody long to get these things sorted?
So it took 10 years to get a trawling ban?
About 10 years in the end, yeah.
From that point, so Dad wrote the article, which in those days, I mean, that was the
2005.
It was 2000. And it kind of went because it was from his heart, you know, like yeah. it was basically that story he just told about seeing that devastation and the fish pop outs and everything. It was that story in an article and it was from the heart. It was so passionate and it kind of went viral in terms of it went into all of the
yachting magazines, diving magazines,
sailing magazines. So it was kind of the start of the public becoming aware.
Sure.
And also, as I say, the fish stocks then reduced, didn't they? So Sussex Inshore Fisheries and Conservation Authority then I think, came on board, and a great guy called Sean Ashworth was working there at the time. And he was like, actually, we need to get this banned and we need to be kind of the pioneers in the UK to try and get this through. And he started fighting for it, didn't he? But it took a long time because obviously, you know, as we all know, it's those kind of committees. It's the fact that
it had to be word perfect as well.
And we had the trawler men obviously trying to.
Well, there was quite a few threats involved as well. I think a trawler did try and run me down, but it's. I just took Emma Stride. Just
not to reduce it from the heart, but when you start to try and filter that into sort of finances and value, it does go back to what do you value? Because, you know, if I go into somebody's house to get a cake out and then I destroy the house in the process, we all know the value of a house is much more than the value of a cake.
Well, they stole my cake over the end of it.
And in the same way you're talking about the woodland, you know, but we don't have a clear sense of what the value of the house of the kelp forest is in order to make them pay the price from the actions. And that is that's the whole rub, isn't it, here, when we're trying to value nature, not just the individual fish, and what's the cost of that?
Yeah, this is why
we started Sussex Underwater, because we were like, once the ban came in, we were just like, we can't let this happen again.
So tell us about Sussex Underwater.
It's kind of like a community group, really. We're trying to get the community involved in the sea a lot more. And what we're really aiming to do is try and get people to fall in love with the sea creatures like we are. So we put these things onto our Facebook and our, you know, Instagram accounts, and it makes people fall in love with them. And I think that it makes people see that these creatures are so much more than what they thought they were. Do you know what I mean? Mm. I think we have this connection with land animals, but we don't necessarily have the same connection with the sea animals, because I think people never see it. It's out of sight, out of mind. And what we're trying to do is help them to fall in love with those creatures and then they'll want to help them. The other thing I wanted to say about when the trawler ban came in was one of the big things that actually happened was a lady called Sarah Cunliffe, and she basically is a film producer, and she met up with Sean Ashworth, and she is a diver as well.
She'd done her graduate course on kelp.
So she understood she was one of those people that really understood what was happening and why it was happening. And she produced this film, which was then narrated by David Attenborough, and it went to millions of people. And that was the catalyst, really, for public getting on board and behind this campaign. And I think that's really important when we talk about things like this, that we need to understand that it's a community that does this as well. Mm. So Dad was the kind of catalyst. You get these key people involved, but once the community comes on board and once we can get the community on board, that's when these things really, really do happen.
We got a forerunner of what it was going to be like, because we were locked down for a year in COVID.
Mm, yeah.
And the fishermen weren't fishing because there's no market. And I've got a friend who lives in Portsmouth in the Solent, and he said he'd never seen the Solent so clear because all the big boats weren't going out, the big tankers, nothing was happening.
Yeah.
And we could see the same of our way. Mm. The difference what we were seeing, just the clarity of the water and everything else. And so it sat on the minister's desk for a year.
So this was the trawler ban. Yeah, it had gone through, hadn't it? But it was sitting on the desk waiting to be approved during the COVID years.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And like that's, we saw as divers that actually in those COVID years, it just really cleared, the water cleared completely, didn't it? It was amazing.
Yeah. So, I've got to do something about this. So I wrote to everyone. I wrote to Boris Johnson, and then we wrote to David Attenborough, Prince Charles. David Attenborough came back. I just said, can you help? Can you help? Talk, if you get a chance to talk to someone. And David Attenborough wrote back in 2 days saying, I will talk to someone.
Amazing.
And next day, my MP rang me up and said, it's gone through. So I thought, well, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
But that shows how it's all, as you said, Katrine, it's all about connecting the dots.
It is, you
have this moment of the heart in 2005 where you see this stuff and it impacts you, write the letter. Then you start using the internet, you start writing letters. That heart travels to somebody who's got influence and the dots connect. And it is this sort of team effort.
Yeah, it's important.
So are you both seeing the shift
now that the trawlers aren't in there?
Yeah, quite dramatically, actually. The main thing was mussel beds, because the mussel beds, you just tie the bottom back together, rebuild the crust. First year, actually, when we started filming, we found a mussel bed which covered the side of a tennis court. Next year, it was 1,000 metres across.
Wow.
This season, it covered from Worthing, right, 9 miles, right down to Brighton. And it was on ground that we've never seen mussels on before. That was the end of last season. During last winter, we had 14 named gals. So we're expected to go out there and find it's been shot blasted. It wasn't. The mussels are still there.
Obviously, the mussel beds are really important because they filter the water as well. In terms of trying to get the kelp back, we need the water to be filtered to allow more light through.
Water. Same with scallops and all the filter feeders. We have this clear water. Clear water means light. Mm. More light, more light.
Mm. And the kelp actually used to be attached to the mussels in Sussex. Yeah. So Sussex is quite unique in that it's quite a shallow bay. That's why we got a lot of kelp growing there, because it's quite shallow, so the light can get through.
Mm. How long do you think it would take, if everything stays like it is, how long do you think it would take to get back to that Eden that you grew up in?
Well, first of all, the kelp's got to come back. We're not necessarily going to get the same kelp back. This is why it's so important, until we have to, not to put stuff out there, mm-hmm. because you might put the wrong kelp back. Mm-hmm. There might be a kelp, there is one called a Japanese kelp now, which is in the heart, the marinas and that, which is no good for shipping or harbours, but it's brilliant for wildlife. That mm-hmm. might be the one that comes back. If that's the one that comes back, then fair dues. Mm-hmm. But we don't want to interfere in nature. Nature's got to find its own way back, really. Mm.
Yeah, it's about also thinking of climate change. We need to have a kelp that comes back that's resistant to the higher temperatures in the water, mm-hmm. you see. This is the other thing. So we want nature to lead. We're letting nature lead in Sussex so that we can see. But also it's a really good example of if these trawler bans were kind of extended around the country, which is obviously what we would love, Sussex could be a good example of how if you just leave it alone, if you just stop this, you know, one human pressure, then actually we could get natural recovery coming back. So we'd like it to be a sort of shining example of that, really.
But let's say it takes 10 years to come back. Mm-hmm. There's an argument to say that the person that took all that stuff away, or the company that took all that stuff away, is responsible for those 10 years gap, you know, to some extent. And if you had a value on that, it would change the equation quite dramatically.
Yeah.
So I wanted to take a minute to touch on the Sussex Bay pipeline that is coming towards the end of its life as a functioning pipeline. And normally we would restore that environment to how it was before that pipe was installed. But that pipeline has become a really important part of the marine ecosystem in Sussex Bay. And so, like many other marine infrastructure projects, we have to figure out how to handle the transition and handle the fact that it's now part of the environment. And so maybe, Eric, you could talk a little bit about that pipeline in Sussex Bay and your experience of it.
That same pipe you're talking about was put in 1976 by a company called Mackley's. It was the first plastic pipe ever used in the country. Quite a big bore, maybe I think it's 9 or 12 inches across, with staples, concrete staples holding on the bottom. Well, over the years, to keep it down, every spring they put mats across it. Mm. Like you can imagine a sleeping bag or a mattress full of concrete. That goes down across the top to hold it down. That gets undercut by the sea. So you now become a natural reef. They're taking that culture for growing penicillin. They're taking that away and putting it into the normal sewage system. They've got to jump through a lot of hoops to do it, the Southern Water. But that means the pipe is now going to be stopped. You know, they're not going to use it anymore. You have to put the land back to what it was before you started. So it's got so many species of fish on that pipe, different species of fish, and the ground around it, where it makes a wedge shape in the water, the turbines down the back, the plates are there, the mussels are there, we've even got blue lip mussels there. There's so many rarities there, we cannot lose it.
So make sure I got this right. So a pipe comes in, pretty unnatural.
Yeah.
And at the time, somebody might have thought, oh, I don't like this. But then it's become part of the environment.
Oh, exactly.
And now there's life growing in and around. So slowly, almost squatter's rights from the fish have taken it over and made it their own.
Yeah.
So how do you feel about it now?
But the thing is, it's part of nature there now, really. And it's actually the key, we feel as divers, it's the key to Sussex Bay recovering, actually, now. Because all the kelp's gone.
Yeah,
right.
And so actually, this is the place now that all of the fish, all of the creatures kind of habitat in and protects them. And it's like their nursery ground. So we feel it's kind of a key. The other thing is also, it was the last place that the kelp disappeared from.
The trawlers couldn't go across it.
Because the trawlers couldn't go across it.
This is a key to redoing the whole of Sussex Bay. Yeah. We've got other little spots, but that is one of the main keys.
So what we'd really love is that, you know, we'd love to keep that in place. We'd love it to be another example maybe of being able to work together with different companies, different, you know, like the Crown Estate and Smith Klein, to be able to say, look, nature is coming back.
If we can keep it there, it can become a nature trail. We can buoy it up in the summer. Mm. We've just built a fish habitat, 3.5-ton fish habitat, which we're going to put in either later this year or in the spring. That would be part of it. And we'll have a nature trail going out to sea. Well, eventually we can put cameras on that nature trail so the kids in the classrooms can log straight in.
I think it's a fascinating story or picture that I'm sure is replicated many, many, many times around our coastline, where
I think it is.
It kind of shows the complex and imperfect situation we find ourselves in.
Yes.
Where we've done so much stuff over the generations.
Yeah.
And we all know that story. But what do we do now? Where do we go from here? And, you know, how do we redeem it?
One of the takeaways from this conversation for me is about how nature adapts to what we do to it. And so we can't just bluntly just reverse what we did, because nature is adapted.
Exactly.
And we have to be more nuanced in our approach to nature recovery and think about how has nature responded to what we've done over the decades and centuries, and what do we now need to do to support it?
You know, so as we, you know, as you both sit looking forward now, 3 years into the trawler ban, and you imagine the future where you want your coastline to be in 15, 20, 30 years for your grandkid, what do you want to see happen?
We would love to see the kelp forest come back. Whether that happens or not, we don't know yet. But we have got some recovery starting to happen in Bognor, which is Bognor Reef, which is like a rocky boulder reef where the trawlers couldn't trawl. But we're starting to see it sort of spread and get, you know, more life coming back there, which is what we'd love to see across the whole of the bay, really. But I think what we'd really love is also is like to see, and what we are seeing, is the community kind of gathering around the sea to see what's, you know, to becoming more part of the sea as well, make sure the community love it and are part of it. And we are seeing that a lot since COVID. You know, there's a lot more sea swimmers, there's a lot more people going out on their paddle boards. There's all these people now that are invested in the sea. Mm. And I think that's what we would love to see as well, to see it be, you know, Sussex Bay being kind of seen as like an amazing sort of marine protected area that we can, you know, show off to the rest of the UK as somewhere as a shining example of, you do protect the sea and the life and the tourist industry, leisure industry that comes back with it. You know, that would be what we would love to see.
And is there anybody that you would love to be in conversation with?
I'm in touch with most of them already.
Yeah, I mean, the Crown Estate is a big one.
Yeah. Well, that's great.
So it's great to be here with Matt.
Well, that's great.
Yeah, so, because the Crown Estate own the seabed, don't they? So that's a big thing. So
You were mentioning the trawler ban and the kelp forest in the Sussex Bay. We've worked to some extent with the councils in making that happen by creating new leases for that area of seabed, so that the councils have the control to keep the trawlers out of the bay and to support kelp forests.
I'm really surprised what you've been doing.
Absolutely.
I try and keep out the technical side, but there's a lot happening in the background that we don't even know about. Yeah, it's good.
So if someone's listening to this then, not the big companies, but an individual person who lives relatively near the coast there, what's the one thing that you'd recommend they go and do right away to get connected, to get more involved, to build their relationship with the water?
Join our social so you can see what's going on with what we do. So Sussex Underwater Social.
We'll put that link in.
Yeah, that would be lovely. It also, look at the Sussex Kelp Recovery Project. That's another big project. There's sort of science behind what's going on as well. But I think just getting down to the beach and connecting with nature. Mm. And it's amazing, again, in the last sort of 3 years, I've become so much more connected since I've been doing all this with your dad, haven't I? Mm. And you walk along the tide line and you can see all these incredible things. Like you see even on the beach, the life coming back because you've got things like the, what they used to call mermaid purses, you know, which are the undulate ray egg cases. You can see the sort of dogfish cases. You can see all this cuttlefish bones. You can see that there's life out there now.
Well, I'm a massive fan of you guys. I'm really chuffed that you could make it up here to speak to us. That's all part of the interconnectivity, isn't it? Going out to different groups to talk with different people, make different connections. So I'm delighted you could make it up. Thank you so much for coming into The Conduit. Matt, thank you for making time.
Thanks, Dave.
Always insightful. We will see you next time.
Thanks for listening to Shaping Places from The Conduit and The Crown Estate. If you've enjoyed the conversation, follow the show wherever you get your podcasts. For any links or resources mentioned today, check the show notes in your podcast app. I'm Dave Erasmus with Matt Mason, and we record at The Conduit in London. Until next time, take care of yourselves and look after each other.